Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music from and conversation with the Duke of Earl, Gene Chandler, who's part of an all-star lineup coming to San Bernardino soon. We'll have details later in the program. First, though, Emmanuel Rogers gives us more on a recent historical fiction looking at the Revolutionary War through the eyes of an ancestor of the author, a farmer who served from the last day of the Continental Army's existence until the last unit disbanded.
Joining us today is author Charles E. Fry. Charles is here to speak about his new book, The War Has Begun. Thank you for joining us today, Charles.
Thank you, Emmanuel. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Oh, man, it's an opportunity for us all, so thanks for coming in. Charles, your book, The War Has Begun, is the first of four in a series titled Duty in the Cause of Liberty. But before we get into The War Has Begun, I would like to ask you, who is Isaac Fry in relation to you?
Isaac Fry is my great times four grandfather, and he was a New England farmer in the town of Wilton, New Hampshire, heading into the Revolutionary War. And that when he left to respond to the alarm that Paul Revere had given, he was in his field plowing or working on some trees, and then the alarm came and he rushed back in and told his wife, "The war has begun, I must be going."
Okay. Charles, before we continue about the book, I understand that you are a geographer, a cartographer, an information scientist, and U.S. Army veteran. How has these occupations helped in preparing for writing these books?
Well, the geography part actually melds really well with the idea of doing historical research. They're very similar in a sense that the research you do is feels a lot the same. History is expressed differently, so instead of maps and spatial understanding, it's arguments. And then being a cartographer, I spent a lot of years making maps. So I've made, you know, literally more than 1,000 maps. And the skill and the technical knowledge that came with doing that gave me some essential things for doing and organizing the research behind this story. And what I was also finding as a veteran then was that I was the first U.S. Army veteran since Isaac Fry in my family. We had a lot of Navy men, but I was the first one in the Army. And what I found was that the things that, in particularly as you go into basic training and through your training in the Army, there are things you learn later that are common elements that everybody sees in the military. And I was finding that those common elements weren't just with today's military, but they go all the way back to the beginning.
As I started reading the book, you talked a bit about their training and all. How was their training different from yours?
Well, their training was part of their weekly routine. Okay. So the militia back in those days, which was set up to protect towns from incursions from usually Native Americans, the idea was that they would meet once every week at the meeting house and they would drill for a few hours as part of the Sunday activities. And they were working from the point of view of what the British Army was giving them as a convention for warfare. So the idea of standing in ranks, marching in formation, and following orders to fire, whether they were standing or whether they were to kneel or even get on their bellies, so something that was just part of the manual of arms for that day.
Charles, for the book, The War Has Begun, you created maps of Wilton, New Hampshire, and the surrounding areas. Why did you do this, and how did you do this?
The why first was that I wanted to ultimately imagine putting your pencil down on a map, and I wanted to draw the entire Revolutionary War by tracking where my ancestor Isaac Fry went. And what I discovered early on was that a modern map wasn't going to do that. The place names had changed. We've actually changed a lot of the hydrography in the landscape by making dams and lakes and ponds and so on. So the landscape, you know, at a detailed level just isn't the same. So I decided I needed a base map from which to chart this story. And so I spent several years actually going through primary source documents of maps that were finished before 1784. So this way I was sure that I didn't include any modern place names or locations. And so I used geographic information systems, which is what I produce in my day job, and I knew the technology very well. And that allowed me to approach the idea of creating this kind of complete map of the part of North America where Isaac Fry went during the American Revolution.
Charles, in The War Has Begun, the story begins on April 4th, 1775. What is Isaac's role in preparing for the coming conflict?
So he had just attended a town meeting for Wilton where they had gotten the instructions from a county congress, if you will.
Okay.
It's actually one of the few county congresses that proceedings of are recorded. And in particular, they gave the go-ahead for the towns to begin preparing their militias to respond to the need if Massachusetts should say, we need help. Massachusetts was worried about the British Army going in and stealing cannons and guns and so on. And it was basically the events that led to the Battle of Lexington and Concord.
How did Isaac become to be chosen to be the person in his town to be that help?
So this is one that's kind of a theory for me.
Okay.
Because my question was fundamentally was, how did he become an officer in the militia? He was relatively young. He had moved to Wilton only a few years earlier. So in some ways, he was still the new guy in town.
Right.
The advantages he had was he had an uncle who was a full colonel in the provincial militia and was in a different town, though. Mm-hmm. So he had a good reputation.
Good.
But then as I did some of the research, I was at the New Hampshire State Archives, and they have all the court records from provincial New Hampshire when the British were running things.
Okay.
And that included Isaac being sued, I think, 9 times before 1775. And it was always for non-payment of something. And so the thing I was looking for was, what was he doing? And that was, he was just setting up his farm. But then there was 2 of these that were particularly interesting, and they were from a guy named Paul Dudley Sargent. Paul Dudley Sargent was the commander of the militia for the county.
Okay.
And Paul Dudley Sargent didn't collect on either of these suits. And I suspect that he offered Isaac something for services in kind because he needed staff officers and needed volunteers to do that.
Right. Okay. Now, was Isaac one of the Minutemen?
Yes, and that was one of my early questions, is whether he would have considered himself a Minuteman.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was that any town who was agreeing to furnish militia to respond to an alarm in Massachusetts was assigning a number of their militia to be Minutemen and respond instantly.
Right. So when Paul Revere was actually doing his run, Isaac was actually helping to get the word out also.
Yes, and this was back to that original thing he told his wife, is like, I kept wondering, how did he know a war was beginning?
Yeah.
And it turned out they were planning to have an armed response to the British Army. So this was potentially a war.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't say we might be getting into a conflict or something. He just said the war has begun. And so he was ready.
Exactly. And it goes to show the details that, you know, we often miss in history. We get the end result, but not the why and the how.
Yeah. Yeah, because you included on the Minutemen, there were 25 privates, 2 company officers, and 2 sergeants at $6 a month. And I was wondering, can they live off of that back then?
Well, you have to take 2 things into account. Okay. One is that they don't have the same expenses we do today.
So right.
They're not paying for cell phones, and they don't have car payments. And horses cost a lot less than cars back then.
Okay.
And then take into account inflation. And roughly, you could multiply by between 500 and 1,000, and that's the amount of money that they would have had in today's dollars.
Ah, okay. So they were doing all right as far as pay goes.
Right. They could afford to get muskets and clothes and so on.
Okay. Now, so the war is begun. Isaac is moving off to go join his regiment and all and get his orders. But there are things that are going on in our country because it's very young. What were the challenges faced in logistics, first off?
So that was one of those things where they planned to respond, mm-hmm. but then I got the sense that they didn't have much more than that as a plan, because what was still going on was that the British were effectively in power, so that's where the state and county governments were still seated and run from the perspective that the king was in charge.
Right.
And the moment that alarm went off, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire essentially ousted their imperial government. They ousted the king's people and set up their own congresses. And so the next thing they had to do was figure out how to have an appropriations committee, because they needed to pay for this. And the thing that surprised me the most was that these men actually decided that they were going to be the ones who were on the hook for the money. So they actually issued bonds in their own names.
Wow.
So imagine today's city council doing that.
Yeah, no, I can't. Yeah. No, I can't do it. Okay, now, that's logistics. Troop movement. How difficult was it for troop movement? Because we're talking about weather, food, and supplies like that, and people having orders and things that they just weren't clear on, because you get so many people moving around talking about so many different things and so many fronts needing to be, you know, watched and protected. So how smoothly did the troop movements go?
I think initially the further out you were, the easier it was, because you all knew you were heading generally towards Boston.
Okay.
And the closer to Boston you got, the more you needed current intelligence about where should you be going. Is it in Boston? Is it near Boston? Is it Medford? You know, which place should you go? And the lucky thing for the further ones out is that they weren't going to make it all the way to Boston on that day. Mm-hmm. And you had places like Concord and Lexington that had been focal points for the battles during the day, and you had people there that could help say, okay, stay here tonight and then go to this location tomorrow. And so that worked out really well. And then it turned out that the towns had already figured out that there would be people taking wagons of food in the next day, because you know, you couldn't carry more than a day or two of food yourself. And if it was going to go to a long-term thing, then you had to have some kind of organized system. And it turned out that the New Hampshire towns, for instance, were urged by their representatives in the new Congress, so to speak, that they should take turns sending food and provisions to the militia that were surrounding Boston.
Wow. Now, I understand that the British also had spies in the different towns that they knew they were going to be approaching soon. You had some spies. I think I remember there were some guys in a field watching people. How well embedded were these spies to these small towns?
At the time of the alarm, there wasn't anything to tell the difference between a neighbor who was for the cause or definitely against the cause.
Okay.
And around that time, the governments realized they needed to do something. They called it an association test.
Right.
And that's where they would take a document back to the meeting house and have everybody sign it to make sure that they were on their side.
Right.
And some people actually had enough honor to say, no, I'm not on your side, and they didn't sign it. Now, if you were living in New England in those days, that usually meant you were under house arrest. And there were also a few people that were called more enterprising, and they signed anyway just so they could be disruptive. And so they would want to see what's going on, figure out what they could do to cause some chaos. There was one incident where a man was actually a militia captain, or he posed as one, and he basically said, you guys can go home now. And he actually sent about 200 men home.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was so interesting because you have in your book the character speaking about the two guys in the field I think I referred to earlier as, yeah, we know who they are. We're not really bothered by them. Why did they have that type of attitude as far as, you have spies here. You know these guys are not for us. Are they not important?
It's interesting that the way you say that, because I think what happens is that they look like everybody else.
Okay.
So initially, you're not as worried about it. Where the alarm came from was another officer was marching in, and he actually saw these other troops marching away, and he was like, wait a second, where are you going?
Right.
I know this isn't right.
Okay.
And so the history of it was that he went in and talked to the commanding officers, and then everybody got excited about that. And it wasn't until the commanders realized that they were losing people that they shouldn't be, that something was actually wrong.
Okay. Now, these are everyday average folks, right? So they're not trained by CIA or Pentagon or anything like, even the training that you and I had in the military.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, if it looked normal, they assumed it was normal.
All right. Wow. They had a lot to deal with. So the war has taken off. Isaac has left the farm. He has talked to his wife. What did you learn about the men who were leaving their farms, their families, and everything behind, and how they dealt with that?
So there were two sides to that. So there's the guilt that the men might have had.
Okay.
Although I think they were also pretty excited to be where they were at.
Right.
They thought they were doing something important and I think dominated their thoughts.
I'm glad, yeah.
But I also saw that particularly Isaac's wife was 6 months pregnant and taking care of three children ages 1, 3, and 5.
Wow.
And I was thinking for a long time, how in the world did that work out? And so over time, I found, looking at the genealogy, that her parents had actually moved to Wilton a few years earlier.
Okay.
Which included her youngest sister. And so she actually did have a support network through her family. And towns back in those days had a much stronger sense of community in the sense that they were their own economies first. So
right.
If one neighbor got good cucumbers and the other one didn't, they traded.
All right.
It wasn't a big thing to do that. It was normal.
And the war has begun. I want to give you an opportunity to give us a bit of a summary of what you were hoping to get across when you wrote this book.
So I was realizing that I had a big opportunity just to record some of my family's history, and I wanted my family members to have that.
Okay.
And then I was also seeing that as I was doing that, I was doing some things that nobody I'd seen anywhere doing before. So, for instance, recording the military history of the 3rd New Hampshire Regiment, which is where Isaac's, which that was his regiment.
Right.
Recording the history of where the New Hampshire troops were going and doing it in a way that was a lot more approachable. as in, you know, I don't know about you, but you know, reading history books, particularly older ones, is pretty dry. Mm-hmm. It tends to be more about the commanders and events and timelines than it is about people.
Yes. Yes.
And that's probably the biggest thing that I learned in researching history is that it's about people.
Right.
And I wanted to tell a story that was about the people, and in particular, Isaac and the people he knew and operated with.
You mentioned wanting us to know about the middle class, how they were affected, because you're right. We often hear about people like George Washington, Cornwall, and all these other people, but we don't hear so much about the people that had to leave their farms and their wives. So during this period, how did this affect the middle class? Did it help to strengthen them, give them confidence in their own country? Or did it help them to see that they were a part of a class?
I think before the war, there was this sense of you're stuck in your class, or you can move up one class in life.
Right.
And there was always a few people who were the exception, and that's where we started seeing the middle class with merchants and the ability to trade and make a fortune that way. But the idea that, like Isaac, when he started the war, he was what people would have called a yeoman back then, which was, you know, somebody who was landless and able to work.
Okay.
And he wanted to be, and I see this later in some of his papers, he wanted to sign his name Isaac Fry Esquire, which meant a landed country gentleman.
Right. Okay.
So he had upward mobility in his mind. And I think as the war went on, and particularly once independence was declared, there was this sense that this was possible.
Okay.
And I think that's one of the things that engaged men to stay in the military and the army longer to see it through.
Ah, so now they actually have a dream beyond what the king and those noblemen tell them. They can move up.
Right. Because I think for the first part of the war, you know, for a year, like most of 1775 and into 1776, nobody knew what was going to happen. You know, a war had been started and there was a lot of blood on a lot of people's hands.
Right.
And how do you get that reconciled? And so independence was the thing that the Americans could see as a way to, you know, have a clean break, get what we want, and not have, you know, massive repercussions beyond what was already happening in terms of loss of life.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Redlands author Charles E. Fry. Fry will be discussing his book, The War Has Begun, at the A.K. Smiley Public Library in Redlands, Monday, August 13th at 6 p.m. More from Fry at dutyinthecauseofliberty.com. Also, that was just a small portion of the interview with Fry. We'll have more in the near future. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Up next, Gene Chandler. Now, while Chandler had quite a few million sellers, he's probably best known for and as the Duke of Earl. But before that, he was part of the Duques. Let's start, please, with the Duques. Were they already in existence when you joined?
Yeah.
Okay, so how did that come about? Were you just a fan and sang along and they liked it? How did that one work that you joined the Duques initially?
One is because we were in the same neighborhood, but I was not aware of them. I was going to Inglewood High School, and they had what they call a citywide high school contest. And each auditorium, whoever won that contest would be representing that particular school at a big ball later on for a contest to win a recording contract and to go on radio every Sunday and sing and perform. There was a DJ in Chicago at that time. It's an old DJ called McKee Fitzhugh. And he was from WOPA, a station I don't think is no longer in existence in Chicago. But he had this big contest. To make a long story short, the group that I was with was called the Gaytones. The Gaytones won the Inglewood High School contest. So that put us in position to represent the school at the big ball later on. Well, when the group that was in the Inglewood area where I was living at found out that I was the lead singer for that particular group, the Gaytones from Inglewood, because a lot of the kids went to Inglewood from my neighborhood, they came to me and said to me that they thought I should be their lead singer because we're all in the same neighborhood, we're close, and we should be able to do it, blah, blah, blah. Hmm. Eventually, I joined them.
I saw my baby at the picture show. Oh, she was someone in the very front row. I said, oh, baby, ain't I all you met? She said, come and sit beside me. You can hold her hand. A girl, a devil, a cute little devil. Oh, she's a devil, a cute little devil. The girl is a devil. She tried to make a monkey out of me, but I love her so.
We ended up, the Gaytones, winning the citywide contest. And it was at that point that they came and asked me to join them. And that's when I joined the Duques.
Okay, okay. Now, I understand that, I guess, before any recordings with the Duques, you ended up in the Army before any of those recordings. Is that right?
Correct. I went in when I was about 17 and a half. I came home in 1960, of course, April of 60 in July. I became 20 years old,
okay.
And the Duques had a recording contract that they had just received, and they asked them to wait until I came home because they had said that they would hold my spot for me. They even told the lead singer they had that when I came home, I was going to be their lead singer again.
Hmm.
Well, during the time I was in the service, I had begun to sing in for Special Forces into the different clubs, officers' clubs, sergeant clubs, whatever. I sort of liked singing by myself. And I had come home planning on having a solo career. But, of course, the Duques had a recording contract waiting. The only problem was the people who owned the record company said, well, we picked you for the lead singer that you had. So they told them the story. So they agreed to wait for me. I was coming home in 3 months. And they agreed to wait. And, of course, the rest is history. When they heard me, they decided it was okay, it was fine, and we went on from there.
And so was this The Girl is a Devil? Was that the first one that you guys recorded?
Very first one. And it was big locally in Chicago, but the people who had the company didn't have the knowledge of how to spread it around the country.
With The Girl is a Devil, I don't know who wrote this one, if this was yours or somebody else's, but if it was yours, is this by chance a true story? Took her to a dance and she danced with everybody else, basically?
That was written by Bernice Williams. She ended up being our manager, the lady by the name of Bernice Williams. She did the writing on that as well as a few others. The Big Live Festival of Love was written by my cousin, who was the female singer in the Duques.
Mm.
Shirley Johnson is her name.
Mm.
She wrote Festival of Love. Bernice Williams was writing songs.
Hey, hey, boy, you must be out your mind. Ain't you heard of curfew time? Whoa, whoa, night out. Daddy told you long ago not to come in late no more. Running over town just like a clown. But you think that he's a square, and you feel you've been everywhere. Wait till tomorrow you sit down. Oh, I'll night out strolling with his dark glasses on his eyes. Oh,
Night Owl was very instrumental in, well, let's put it this way. The recording company that we were with needed to get some money for our next recording session. So Bernice Williams, again, she wrote Night Owl like she did The Girl is a Devil. And they needed the money to get it. This company, VJ Records, bought the publishing for the song. They sold the publishing to VJ for the Night Owl record.
Daddy ought to make you work, whoa, whoa, Night Owl. Night out. You better come in, boy, it's getting late. I told you about staying out times of night.
Doop, 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 a barrel, 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 doop, doop, a barrel, doop, 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 a barrel, doop, doop.
Through this world, nothing can stop the Duke of Earl and the you.
Now, when the session was over with, it was the same session that we put Duke of Earl in.
Right.
The Duke of Earl was in that session along with Night Owl. And, of course, I wrote the Duke of Earl. And I gave a piece to the guy in the group. His name was Earl. And I gave a piece to Bernice because she finally heard the song. She asked me, could she put one line in there? I said, yeah, let's hear it. And when she gave it to me, it was like a perfect line for that part of the song. The line she put in there, we'll walk through my dukedom, and paradise we will share. That was the line that she put in.
We'll walk through my dukedom, and the paradise we will share. Yes, I
of us became writers on that song. By that time, Carl and Maris had found someone who would be able to take our records national. So he had the choice to make out of the recording session. He turned down the Duke. He chose the Night Owl song. Okay, the Night Owl song went out there. It was going up the charts. And the people who bought the publishing on it, prior to it going up the charts, let me say that, they wanted to hear it. And when they heard it, they said, what else did you record? They played some of the other songs. They said, well, who owns that song? Record company owner of BJ, her and her husband, Jimmy, they heard that Duke of Earl song and they said, you're right, this sounds like a hit. So they called Hewitt Abner, who was running the company at that time. Ironically, he was in Europe making the first deal for the Beatle records.
Oh, wow, nice.
You know.
That's
DJ
cool.
is the first ones who had the Beatle records, and he was made to deal with Blind Epstein. He said, if you call me all the way to Europe for a song, then just go on and buy it, okay? So they bought the song for what sort of leased the record, let's put it that way, from Carl Davis and Bill Bunky Shepherd, who owned the label Nat Records, is what I was on. So Abner comes home, he hears the song, and they decided to go with it, but they had to get somebody to be the lead singer. I was the lead singer on the song, but I'm singing with the Duques, and I'm out there with Night Owl, and we're happy because we got a first chart record going up.
Yeah.
So they gave me a choice, to make another long story short, to stay with the group, and they would give somebody else the name on the Duke of Earl, even though I wrote it, they would give them the name as the artist. And since I came home in the first place to be a single artist, now I got a chance with another label. I figured I had to do an album. And in there somewhere, I had confidence that I would have me a hit record, even if the Duke didn't hit. So the rest is history. They released the Duke of Earl, and of course, the Duke of Earl took off, and I never looked back.
That's Music in Conversation with Gene Chandler in San Bernardino soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll Volume 2, along with Sonny Turner, Kathy Young, and several more. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Hey, do you mind sharing, by the way, folks could read this at your website easily enough, simply genechandler.com. But if you would share how Duke of Earl came about, because it really is exactly what it sounds like.
We were at a rehearsal. And in that rehearsal, we had begun to open up our throats, and so we would just sing anything. So we were saying, do, D-O, do going up the scales. And we began to clown. But it sounded kind of nice to me, so I began to put some lyrics to it. And so next thing you know, see, there's no such thing as a Duke of Earl, not in real royalty.
Right, right.
You can be the Earl of something, and you can be the Duke of something.
Yeah.
But those are two different titles, Earl and Duke. Well, what do I know? I'm a young guy, and I had never been to England. I just know I saw it in movies, and for somewhere it came in my head, the Duke of Earl. Mm. Now, there's a Duke of Earl now, because that's me, you know.
Yeah.
it reminds me of when they had the guy going up to the Olympics, mm-hmm. when they were in the Olympics in England, and the announcers were talking to the English people, asking this guy about royalty. And so he started running down with the royalty, the prince and the princess, et cetera, et cetera. And so when he finished, the guy from America said to Will, what about the Duke of Burgundy? And he looked real strange. He looked at the Duke. He said, you know, Duke. He said, oh, you're talking about Gene Chandler, Duke of Burgundy. But anyway, he said, well, you all got royalty over there. We have royalty in America. So that was nice.
You know, in all honesty, I always read it as earls are one thing, okay? And that is one step in royalty, but the Duke of the other earls, so that's like creme de la creme. I just thought that was a funny, funny story. Is this the same time when you went over to VJ that you stopped being Eugene Dixon and that's when you became Gene Chandler?
That's when the change came. That's because I just liked the actor Jeff Chandler.
Yeah.
And I took that and shortened the Eugene to Gene and became Gene Chandler.
Okay. I read that it was less than a month or maybe just barely over a month, something like that. This one went gold. That's just huge. That's just quick to see it go like that.
It was phenomenal. I mean, I just can't explain to you how that record took off. And of course, I didn't know what I really had. I just know I finally had a big record and I was on my own. And everything that came about from that, I mean, I think that year was the 61, 62,
yeah.
In 62. It became the number one record, I think, about February or March of 62. And I was in Hollywood making a movie, the next thing I knew. The thing's moving fast, and I just don't know how to explain it, but it was nice. That's what I can say.
Yeah. And I think I can ask this, and I think you can answer it without disrespecting anybody, but The Twist was in the number one position for such a long time, and it was just everywhere. And it was finally the Duke of Earl that knocked The Twist from its number one position. Was that something
That's
that
correct.
It was just nice to be like, okay, finally we're not going to hear The Twist as much?
Well, you know what I remember? I always will remember who I knocked out of first place, which was Chubby Checker.
Yep.
And then who knocked me out of the number one slot was Ruth Chanel, Hey Baby.
Wow.
Now that I remember, okay.
Yeah, I think that would be more memorable. Who knocked? Yeah, okay, well.
So. Yeah, because it was the number one record, and it was my only number one, so it's not hard to remember, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There are others, though, you did quite well on, if not on the mainstream charts, the R&B charts. There's some you got up to 3 and 12 and all that. We'll hit those after a bit.
I've had million sellers, yeah.
Oh, yeah, 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 all over the place.
You can have a million seller and not hit number one.
Right,
you know?
Right, absolutely. Well, just hanging on to the Duke of Earl for just one more thing. When you started with the whole Duke outfit with the cape and monocle and hat, was that your idea? Were you kind of clowning and it just became the thing? Or was that management? Hey, capitalize on the song. Is there a great one behind this?
I'm laughing because, listen, your knowledge that you have is really good because you're hitting right on the head of a lot of things. Well, no, they wanted me to dress up like, you remember the Minutemen's back in the day when they were coming to see, and the British are coming, they had
sure.
The triangle hats on.
Sure, sure.
And the white stockings that come up to your knee, and then the pants start.
Yeah.
And the blouse-like shirt with the short jacket and the triangle British hat.
Right.
And they had me holding it like Napoleon on my stomach and standing up tall and Edwardian-like. And so what happened is, I would have looked at the negative, not, I'm new in the business, so that was their idea of the Duke of Earl. Well, it wasn't necessarily my idea, but they're supposed to be the pros, and they've been in this business a long time, so I figured they knew what they was doing. But then once I looked at the negative and saw what it looked like, I said, absolutely not. And I took the only negative, and I have that negative to this day, that shows me in that outfit with the triangle hat.
Oh,
in any event, I left the studio. I mean, there was a lot of noise about it, and finally they went along with me. I told them I wanted to be a modern-day Duke, not somebody back in time. I didn't visualize that when I put the song together, okay?
Right. You know?
So in any event, that's when they sent me out to get the top hat, the cape, the cane, the monocle, the red sash, the tuxedo, and all that kind of thing. And that's how the picture came about, with the cape.
Has that negative that you have you made that into a picture? Does that exist somewhere?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I didn't want anybody to see it.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
to this day.
If I have it, I'll show it to you.
Okay.
But it's not for anybody to keep or do anything with. You know,
sure,
I'll just
sure.
show it to them. Right. And they'll get the idea of what I'm talking about.
Way cool. Okay. All right. Nice. Nice.
Listening to KVCR, it's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Back now to Gene Chandler in San Bernardino soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll Volume 2. We'll have more information on that later in the program. Jumping up a bit, just a few years, I suppose, with Rainbow, and I know that this one was recorded several times, and the reason I bring this one up is, well, one, the fact that it is a tune that he recorded several times, but mainly, though, this is a Curtis Mayfield tune. He wrote that and maybe a few other things, and from your website, says that your collaboration with Curtis Mayfield proved to be a, quote, a match made in heaven. So with Rainbow, I think A Man's Temptation, he seemed to write songs that really fit you well. Was that how it was from the start with Mayfield's tunes?
Yes. He called me up one day and told me to listen to some tunes, and he called me. I went to his home, I listened to some songs, and I was sort of like a romantic type individual. Mm. And he wrote these songs that were like crying and talking about different love and different things. And it sort of fit the groove that I love. And I started singing. The Rainbow itself was hit three different times.
Yeah.
And funny thing, they didn't want me to record it. They thought that it went too long before it got to the bridge.
Oh.
And I didn't even think how long it was. All I knew is I loved the feel. I could sing it with passion. I felt everything about it. And so that's what I did. Let me just tell this brief story. What happened
sure.
is we were coming with the answer to Mary Wells' song, You Beat Me to the Punch, and we were going to record You Threw a Lucky Punch. And so they went in the studio to get that. They said, okay, we'll record it, because I told them I wasn't going in if I didn't record it. So I recorded it. Now, when it was finished, they were coming with You Threw a Lucky Punch. I asked him, I say, at that time, the B-side was generally a throwaway song.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't going for that. And in any event, they released the song. I asked them to put Rainbow on the throwaway side as a B-song. When I hit the road, all I would sing was Rainbow. Even though You Threw a Lucky Punch was going up the charts. With Bullets, by the way. But I love the Rainbow. And I'll never forget, I was in Washington, D.C. at the Howard Theater. I got a phone call from Carl Davis, my producer. And he said, well, I guess you were right. He said, in Richmond, Virginia and Newark, New Jersey, they turned the record over and started playing Rainbow.
Mm.
And the telephones lit up. Okay, so I had a hit off Rainbow.
Yeah.
The crowd kept hollering more and more every time I would sing it. So I would come back and embellish on it. And eventually I made up the second part of what I would do, because it was happening everywhere I went.
Uh-huh.
And so I put together this part. Okay, that was 63. 1965, 2 years later, they recorded me live in the Regal Theater. They called me down to the studio and said, man, you got to listen to this. I want you to hear this. I said, what? They said, just come on down here. It was the audience reaction to me doing Rainbow.
Mm.
And they decided to release Rainbow and call it Live 65 Part 2. And my God, it took off again when that song was released in 65, the live version. Now, in 1980, 15 years later, 2 years prior to 80, we had begun to put an oldie from the 60s in each one of my new albums.
Okay.
And I got a call from Carl. This was 80, when we was getting ready to do another album. He said, Gene, I got an idea. Why don't we do Rainbow as one of the oldest from the 60s? It's from the 60s. I said, man, we done had a hit off of it twice. Nobody want to hear that again. He said, I don't know. Let's try it again. So we didn't do a live, but we did a studio version of the live version without
right.
the audience, of
right.
course. And we were going with a song called Does She Have a Friend for Me, which was like a disco.
Yes.
And that song began to go up the charts. But at that time, they would release a single first and then later on come with the album. They came with the album like, you know, well, maybe a month or so after.
Mm-hmm.
And the album was entitled Rainbow 80. And that record took off again. And the other one began to slow down because they were playing Rainbow 80.
I want to ask about the British invasion and how this affected you. I feel like with you, much like Gene Pitt, rest in peace, and the Jive Five, he very much changed with the times. It was doo-wop starting in 61, and then there was more of a soul and even leaning toward the dance and disco later on. Did you do this because of the British invasion? You did change the sound over the years.
It wasn't because of the British. It was because I was searching for a hit. And so I was reaching out, and of course everybody wanted to go pop and just not just R&B.
Yeah.
And so I reached out and got me another two more million sellers, you know. What happened was when they were playing disco, if you remember,
yep,
they very seldom played a slow song.
Right.
And they
right.
just kept playing all the disco songs.
Yep.
So we were getting ready to do an album, and so I told my producers, I said, listen, we need to do some disco. So I took a song that I had in my publishing company that was just a regular up-tempo song called Get Down.
Yeah.
And I changed it over to the disco music so I would be in the same competition with everybody else and not just trying to throw something out there and it die with a bunch of slow songs.
Yep.
Or a regular beat. And yeah. So they went along with me, and we changed Get Down into a disco. And I sold a million records on it between two companies because they changed the company from RCA over to another company. We had Get Down over there.
Well, that one is just a monster of a hit in the world of disco. And I found a wonderful 8-minute or so version of it. I don't know if this is somebody else's remix or what, but I love it.
20th Century had it.
And
the producers that we had, they did a long version as well as the regular version. And that's what they did with Get Down. And it became another million seller for me. It was talking about people getting down. You know, I mean, really dancing well. That's the whole idea of saying get down. You really getting down.
Yeah.
That kind of reaction. And if you listen to the lyrics, it talks about if she get down, she can be his lady. If she play her cards right, but you got to get down. You know, you got to be able to dance.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. So it has a story, and it talks about her as a fine, fine, foxy lady and all that kind of stuff, and get down. And so now, I think it was Bootsy Collins, I think, had a song. And in that song, he said, get down, baby bubba. And for some way, it came to me, and I said, I know he had it out, but I'm talking to the females out there, and I'm telling her to get down. So I said, get down, baby bubba.
That's beautiful.
But that's how it was kind of put together, you know. And then, of course, when they did the disco version,
yep,
you know, at that time, they had the long play version, they had the short ones. If the beat was right and people enjoyed it, that's how it went.
Yeah. You know, around the same time as that one, or close to it, somewhere in there, Does She Have a Friend for Me? This is one that you mentioned a little while ago.
That song did kind of well for me.
Yeah?
In the disco field. It didn't do a million seller. It was the song that was out there going up the charts when they came with Rainbow 80.
So Rainbow 80 knocked... one of your own songs slowed down another one off the charts?
Yep.
Well, I don't mean to laugh at that. No, I do. That's funny.
No, it, funny or not, whatever it was, it slowed it down because it was going up the charts. Like you say, it was a nice song.
Mm-hmm.
But when those yachts saw the album when it came out and said Rainbow 80, they started playing on Rainbow 80, and I guess like before, the phones lit up, and they just began to play that more than they did Does She Have a Friend for Me.
Mm. I'd like to go back in time a bit. This is, again, just from your website, GeneChandler.com. that you turned toward other aspects of the music industry, Bamboo Records and all that, and I believe you produced somebody else, Mel and Tim, with Backfield
in
Motion.
Yeah, well, that's when I went into the business end.
Yeah, talk about this period.
Yeah, that was the period, 1970. I left Carl Davis and went up the street and opened my own office and started my own company. It was called Mr. Chan. And I took over another company and released a song called Backfield in Motion that I produced by Mel and Tim, and that was a million seller.
Yeah.
A bad girl. I'm gonna make a mind if it takes all night. Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it? A bad girl. I'm gonna make a mind if it takes all night. Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
There were a few other songs. I was with the A&M Records. I had The Sisters Love, Are You Lonely. Gosh, I probably had about 15 acts.
Mm.
I was producing them all and sort of took over management of most of them. And I had these different companies that wanted me to produce different people. MGM, a guy named Drake or something. But I was just doing so many things, man. I was just happy to be able to get those deals and what have you. I even stopped performing for a while in order to just concentrate on the company. And in that time, I got Groovy Situation,
yes,
which was another million seller for me on Mercury Records. Groovy Situation came out in 1970.
Yes.
That was the year I won the Producers Award of the Year from the Matcher organization. I was up against Gamblin' Huff and Norman Whitfield of Motown, and I just knew I wasn't going to win because they were hot, you know.
Right, right. You don't beat Motown.
The OJs and everybody.
Yeah.
This was in Houston, Texas, 1970, and they called my name, and people had to hunch me to tell me, they just called your name as Producer of the Year. Nancy Wilson was the MC.
I'll never forget
that, because when I went up to the mic, I hadn't written out anything because I didn't plan on beating those guys.
Mm.
And so Nancy, I was talking real low, and Nancy said, "Speak up, Gene." Anyway, I finally got myself together, and I spoke and thanked all of the people and told them I was really surprised and happy and that kind of thing, and that was it. No, I was kind of hot then. I was doing my own thing out there performing, and I was also producing and running record company, publishing companies, and all that kind of stuff. Something that I just can't miss. Oh, it's a groovy situation, a splendid combination that we should meet in a time like this. Oh, it's a groovy situation and a splendid combination.
That's Music in Conversation with Gene Chandler. In San Bernardino soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll Volume 2, along with the Dukes of Doo-Wop, Kathy Young, Charles Weldon, Jimmy Clapton, Larry Chance and the Earls, Norman Fox and the Rob Roys, and from the Platters, Sonny Turner. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Gene Chandler. Thanks also to Emmanuel Rogers and his interview with author Charles E. Fry, and thanks to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions. Thanks also to Patty McGill for spreading the word about these interviews, probably even more than me. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Shireen Awad, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.